There are teams of experts and volunteers who make it their business to go to disaster zones. It's always high-stress work, flying into a place you've never been, bringing in whatever help you can to people you've never met. Matt Capobianco was on the scene of a recent cyclone in Bangladesh with his organization, Global Medic. He remembers meeting one man in particular.
He lost five family members. He lost his mother, his father, his wife, and both of his children. And now he's left with nothing. I mean, that kind of story definitely sticks with you. I mean, what do you offer a guy who's just lost his entire family?
Matt Capobianco has experienced the frustrations of trying to help people. Now he's learning that it's even worse when some government says, "You're not from here. You're not welcome." I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
The latest news of the earthquake in China comes right on the heels of the other current natural disaster, and that is the aftermath of the cyclone in Burma. Today I'm talking with a man whose work takes him to these scenes of devastation, earthquakes, cyclones, floods. Matt Capobianco helps bring in emergency hospitals and water purification equipment. The organization he works for, Global Medic, is already preparing a search and rescue team to go to China, but Matt's main focus is still trying to get his people into Burma. The trouble is that the Burmese military government says it doesn't want foreign aid workers in the country. The BBC recorded a conversation with one British aid worker who did make it into Burma, to parts of the disaster zone that have not yet been seen.
Now, 10 days after the storm, we're only able to gain access to some areas 10 days later. And those areas that are some of the hardest hit, no aid's been able to get in. We were able to get to a village by using dugout canoes, a village that hadn't been reached before. There are many, many areas still to be reached by any agency. There are many areas that have received no aid at all. Every day we hear new stories of discovery and agencies that have found new pockets of communities that they didn't know were there. People are emerging from the disaster zone, having fled, walked for days. Some of them are arriving in boats in search of aid. The other thing that's happening is as the flood waters recede, we're able to gain access to certain areas for the first time, and that's what happened to us today. The waters receded to a level that we were able to get in these canoes and navigate our way. It took us about an hour each way to get to this one village. There are 100 families there that had absolutely nothing. All their homes had been destroyed. All their crops gone. They were drinking contaminated water. Many sick children. Some children on the brink of death because their diarrhea was so severe.
That's an aid worker in Burma who made it into the country and asked that his name not be used. Most of the other international volunteers, doctors, and rescue experts from around the world are still stranded waiting on the tarmac at the airport in nearby Bangkok. That includes Matt Capobianco's people from Global Medic.
Yeah, our crew is currently on the ground in Bangkok, Thailand, trying to obtain visas for entry into Myanmar.
How frustrating is that for you, for them?
It's extremely frustrating when you're sitting on the ground and you've got a lot of aid there ready to go. And it's not only you, it's the international community at large. There's, tons of NGOs who are in Bangkok right now with aid just ready to go and expertise and knowledge in disaster relief ready to help out. And the border has essentially been shut down. And you know that aid is definitely not getting out to anyone beyond the capital from the reports that we're hearing. So, yeah, it's frustration that we have never dealt with before in any of our 30 international deployments. It's extremely tough for our team just to sit and wait. But I mean, that sheer frustration is nothing compared to what the Burmese people are dealing with themselves right now.
It's been 10 days more since the cyclone. I mean, they've got to be running out of time. How much longer can they wait?
Well, I mean, it's never easy to wait, and as the days pass, the numbers of people who are contracting waterborne diseases are increasing, the number of people who are risking starvation are increasing, and the number of people who are dying are increasing. And to me, waiting an hour to get into a particular disaster zone is too long. But I think in that type of situation, it's never too late to get in, because whether or not you're saving a life a day or 3 days later, it's still saving a life.
Matt Capobianco would know. He was on the ground for the most recent major cyclone. It happened in Bangladesh last November when hurricane-force winds and storm surges killed close to 4,000 people and displaced millions more. So when Matt imagines what the scene's like in the countryside of Burma, vivid memories come to his mind.
You would see the roads lined with people. I mean, essentially, these people before, they had, you know, a wooden hut with a tin roof, maybe, if they were lucky, thatch roof for those who were unlucky. And that has been just wiped away from them. And what has happened now is they've moved out of the forest, closer to the roadways, rebuilt a small hut. And the reason for this is because they believe, hey, the people are going to be coming down the roadways with aid. This is the best way I'm going to get aid to help my family and to help my children.
The challenge for organizations like Global Medic is that they work mainly with volunteers, and yet they know they have to move quickly. For example, when there was the first word of the cyclone in Bangladesh, Matt Capobianco and his team kept an eye on the weather and kept phone lines open to their partner organizations in the developing world.
We were in the office, it's probably about 6 o'clock in the evening, and you know, we'd heard in the afternoon that the storm or cyclone was passing through, and we weren't too sure if it was going to turn north up towards the coast of Bangladesh. And that evening we did get word that it had hit from our local partners on the ground, and you know, that the devastation was just huge. When you hear that, you just gear up to go, and you get ready to get out the door as fast as you possibly can.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Matt Capobianco led his team into Bangladesh after a cyclone there 6 months ago. He says the deployments are short because Global Medic believes in bringing in supplies, starting the work, and then leaving the equipment behind so local people can take care of themselves. In a matter of days, the Global Medic team was on its way.
Toronto to London Heathrow and London to Dubai, and then Dubai into Dhaka, the capital. And then once we reached there, grabbed a plane down to a town called Bagarat, and then took a 10-hour truck drive into the coastal regions where we would eventually set up our relief operations.
Do you see anything on your way into Bagarat?
Into Bagarat, it was pretty much nighttime when we were flying in, so it was just darkness, and arrived in the early morning. And we had a truck with some of our gear come meet us down there as well. And then, you know, as we started moving from Bagarat into the cyclone-affected area, you'd see, you know, slowly the landscape change from full trees to trees knocked down to trees blocking roadways.
Tell me what's going through your mind when you're on that drive into the disaster zone. What are you thinking?
You know, it's tough. You're just trying to mentally prepare yourself to, you know, to do the job that you're there for. Because if you spend time simply, you know, focusing on the people who have been hurt and this and that emotionally, then that's time taken away from my production of water, from the production of our hospital. So you just kind of have to mentally separate yourself from that anguish and, you know, get ready to produce for 16 hours a day and then kind of filter all the information on your way home.
I mean, you'll probably have been having many of the same thoughts that I have over the past 10 days, wondering what's going on in Burma and those places where we haven't even seen images of the places that have been washed away. I mean, help me with what you recall seeing on your way into the cyclone and the flood damage in Bangladesh. Is there an image or a photograph that you have clearly in your mind of what you saw when you realized, okay, This is where the people really got hit here.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just in terms of the sheer numbers where you see people just lining the roadways on your way in. You will see bodies floating in the river as you're trucking out water and things of that nature. And in Myanmar, we're getting a sense of that on a larger scale than was in Cyclone Sidur, that there's just bodies just strewn across everywhere, you know, in littering water sources. And one thing we did was with our partner on the ground, they suggested that we pick up burial shrouds. We would go around to different areas, and where they did have bodies, we were providing them with these shrouds so that they could receive a proper burial for the bodies that they had found.
In Bangladesh, Matt Capobianco and his team had their hands full caring for the living. They set up one of their inflatable mobile hospitals in a schoolyard and got to work. He was busy, but once in a while got to sit down with a translator and talk with one of the victims of the cyclone. He's never forgotten one man he met there.
you couldn't understand what he was saying, obviously, with the language barrier at the time, but you could just see, in his eyes that he had suffered something extremely, extremely horrible. And then, you know, when you're talking afterwards with your translator, and he essentially says, the man said he lost five family members. He lost his mother, his father, his wife, and both of his children. And now he's left with nothing. I mean, that kind of story definitely sticks with you. I mean, what do you offer a guy who's just lost his entire family? You offer him some medical treatment. You offer him fresh water, some food, some clothing. You can maybe help him out with some shelter, maybe, you know, a little bit of money here and there. But, you know, what does it mean to a guy that's lost his entire family?
How does it leave you feeling?
You know, it leaves you feeling, you know, a little bit disheartened in a sense. But then when you think to it, the guy, he's still there and he's surviving and he's doing everything he can. You know, this particular guy was, you know, we met him in the community helping out and trying to clear roads, you know, trying to open up access. I mean, you could look at it in one sense that, you know, he's lost everything and it's tough. But then you look at it in the other sense that he keeps going and he's giving back all he can and he's trying to push on in the face of, you know, something that most of us will never experience.
Yeah, and here you are. You've come halfway around the world to, you know, to offer the kinds of services that are so desperately needed. But, you know, there's someone with the kind of problem. You can't fix that, right?
No, I mean, you're never going to be able to give someone their family back. You know, that's just, unfortunately, you can't do that. But, you know, you are there to help them recover and rebuild and, you know, reintegrate the community and keep it going again. And, you know, and it is an extremely important job that we are there for. And it does give hope to a lot of people who have lost just about everything.
Matt Capobianco works with Global Medic. His team and thousands of others are waiting for permission to go to the scene of the cyclone in Burma, but the military government is still saying no. Matt's last deployment was to another cyclone in Bangladesh, and he's talking about what it's like to be there, to see the destruction, and to meet the people. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. It's now been 11 days since the cyclone slammed into Burma, or Myanmar, and still no one's really sure how many people may have died there. They say that over 30,000 people are dead or unaccounted for, but the latest worry is how many people may yet die due to lack of shelter, food, or clean water. That'll almost certainly be made worse by the insistence of the Burmese military government that foreign aid workers stay out of the country. Matt Capobianco is doing the coordinating for the NGO Global Medic. He says he can only imagine what it's like in those villages along the southern Burmese coastline. Matt recently led a team to the scene of a cyclone in Bangladesh. See, Matt's used to disaster zones. He is used to seeing the effects on people, adults and children. So one aspect of the cyclone in Bangladesh caught his attention.
Not only children, I mean, you expect that children obviously are going to be affected in any disaster, but the amount of children we saw come through by themselves, and, you know, we would be treating the children and they would leave and, you know, you talk to the translator and say, hey, are they going outside to meet up with, you know, mom or dad or aunt or uncle, grandmother, grandfather? And they'd say, no, the child's by themselves. They just heard about the hospital and came here because they knew they weren't feeling good and they needed some help. So that is definitely something that, you know, is a little bit unexpected, but I mean, you know, it's going to come. It's very tough to deal with it when it does.
These kids are orphans, is what you're saying.
Essentially, yeah. And a lot of the kids, we were told, they'd already had possibly a mother or father who had passed on previously and were being taken care of by an aunt or uncle or someone in the community. And now the cyclone comes and takes them away, and now someone else from the community is going to have to take them in again.
At his inflatable mobile hospital in rural Bangladesh, Matt Capobianco saw how the effects of a cyclone can turn other ordinary problems into much bigger ones.
There was a man who had come in there with his wife and, you know, talking about a little bit of chest problems and things of that nature. And then, you know, we noticed he's walking with a little bit of a limp, and we took a look at his foot and realized he had some steel lodged in there. And what we thought was simply just, you know, a minor operation became something pretty major. So we had to do some minor trauma surgery on this gentleman. Just seeing the sheer pain in his face, we had to put him on the back of a pole cart bicycle for someone to bicycle him up to the local hospital. Just seeing someone like that in that situation, whereas here, you know, we've got these amazing clinics and, you know, we've got these hospitals in North America that we can just go to and, you know, the majority of the time get things taken care of.
This guy who had the metal in his foot, is that because it's just impossible to make your way around a zone that's been flattened and washed out by a cyclone and a storm surge like that?
Yeah, I mean, that's part of it, in addition to, you know, oftentimes it can be from the actual storm itself that's knocked you over, or it could be from the fact that you don't have shoes and you're walking through bush to try and get to a hospital, or you're walking on a roadway and you pick something up. So we actually did, for the people that were coming out of our hospital, we purchased sandals for them so when they left our hospital, we could try and avoid those type of situations.
And when it comes time for you to leave, how easy or difficult is that? Because, you know, clearly if you're there for a couple of weeks, you've just started trying to help these people put their lives back together.
Yeah, it is tough for me personally when I'm in those situations to leave, because I'd like to stay on and, you know, I'd like to help out and I'd like to help run that relief camp for that much longer. But the fact is that there's always, you know, more work to do at home, and there's always other disasters happening that we have to respond to and that we're needed at. So that's where our training of local partners does come in. And it makes the job a lot easier after 2 weeks when you're leaving to know that the people that you've trained on the ground have become extremely efficient in delivering the type of aid we have and running the type of water units we have. And we know always that the victims definitely are in good hands after we've gone home.
Is it hard to go home and you know, back to a place in the planet where everything works?
Yeah, it's a little bit tough in a sense. You know, you miss sleeping on a table and washing yourself with a rag. You know, it's funny how quickly you become accustomed to doing those kind of things. Every time I go, it gives me a renewed appreciation for everything we have here. I go home and I turn on the tap and I can grab a glass of water. I can, you know, go upstairs and turn on the water and I've got a hot shower right there. You know, I've got food on the table and those things are, for the majority, easily accessible for me.
Is there any guilt in that for you, knowing that, you know, you've always got those kinds of comforts when you spend your working life with people who have lost them or never had them to begin with?
I don't know if it's a sense of guilt as much as an appreciation for what I've been given, you know, and what's been given to me. And that's part of what drives me, is because I do know that there are so many people out there that don't have, you know, the luxuries that I have and aren't afforded that in life and never will be. And that's definitely what keeps me doing and drives me to do what I do, is that I've been given these things and now I have to use these things, you know, to further myself and to give back.
Matt Capobianco works with Global Medic. It's a small NGO based in Toronto. There are Global Medic people who are still waiting to get into Burma, and meanwhile they're preparing a search and rescue team to head to the scene of the earthquake in China. If you've done this kind of work, and if you found that it has a profound effect on you, I'd like to hear about it. You can get in touch with me through our website at thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Story. And I want to follow up on another story that's affecting a lot of us here in the U.S., and that is the price of housing, the cost of mortgages, and the growing number of homes in foreclosure. Florida and California continue to lead the way here. there is a lot for sale and a lot of people desperate to sell to get themselves out of debt. Well, politicians are into the act as well. Congress has just passed a bill that might help people refinance. President Bush says he'll veto it. The Senate has another bill in the works, and so it goes. Somewhere in the mess are the real estate agents. These are the people who've been doing very, very well in recent years and are finding now that their comfy piece of carpet's being yanked from beneath their feet. So I suspect that we could put the work of the real estate agent in Florida into our category of tough job. Zach Finn runs a real estate business in Fort Lauderdale. He's been doing it for 8 years. And so to find out just how dramatically things have changed, I asked him to tell me about the good old days.
I would say my best year with sales was probably about 3 years ago. I was bouncing between appraisals and inspections and closings and having to stop by one closing just to make an appearance to run off to the next one, you know, and then back to another appraisal to go meet another inspector, throw some showings in there, a couple listing appointments and a couple closings. You know, it's just an unbelievable time of just running. We were running around like chickens with our heads cut off. And basically, you know, back then realtors were looked at as order takers, and we were just running around. What do you want? How much do you want to pay? Okay, sign here, press hard, got to go. And, you know, just bouncing between, you know, this seller to this buyer to that buyer to this agent, we were able to get business. I remember when I started with Arvita and they recommended that everybody go get a little name tag and make sure you wear it everywhere. And you used to get people at the grocery store walking up to you, you know, hey, I was thinking about selling my house. I'm thinking about buying something. And not that doesn't still hold true today,
yeah. But
it seemed like certainly a lot more people would just stumble into you. What do you do? Oh, great. Maybe you can help me.
These days, Zach Finn says it's really tough for the people who are trying to sell, but it's also hard for those who are trying to buy.
The deals are far and few between, and once we do put a deal together, it's very difficult to get the deal to close. For people to borrow money nowadays, it's next to impossible.
I read somewhere that there's over 38,000 homes and condos now for sale in Broward County, and just a handful of them selling. Is that accurate?
That number may be accurate. I know that there's about 100,000 homes in the Tri-County area, which is Miami, Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach. If it's 37,000 that are available, I would say a few thousand homes have sold. You know, in this last quarter, maybe 4,000 or 5,000.
So, Zach, why stay in the business? Why not just get a job as a long-haul trucker for a few years? Well, okay, the price of gas isn't so good for that. But, I mean, why not just go do something else and come back when things pick up?
Oh, I love this business. Real estate really has become a passion of mine.
So who is buying now, Zach? I mean, if someone were to come into your office and, you know, with a serious look in their eye, who are the buyers today?
That would be, well, if it was last week, that would be a French-Canadian by the name of Michael. Walked in, I'm looking for a brand new condo on the beach, okay? Mm-hmm. You know, what price point? And he said, oh, I want to be around $800,000. And I love, by the way, when a buyer throws in U.S. dollars after they say the price range that they want to stay in, because it usually means two things. One, they can actually buy a place, and most of these people are coming in and buying cash.
So this guy must have like an entire beach of choices to look at, no?
You'd be surprised to get into an A building. We were looking at the Las Olas Beach Club, which is a phenomenal new building, very contemporary, beautiful high-rise right on the ocean. And for $800,000, you get a really nice unit, you know, in a brand new, beautiful building, but with compromised views. You know, he found that the unit that he really wants is about $1.5 million.
So what's he going to do? Is he going to wait and see if prices come down even further?
That's exactly what he did. He hightailed it back up to Canada, but he will be back down. I am, you know, keeping in touch with him. And
so what do you do, Zach, when Michael turns around and walks out the door? Do you put your head in your desk and go, oh, I lost another sale?
Not really, no. I know that he's going to be a good buyer. It's just a matter of when.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. The lesson from my tough job guest, real estate man Zach Finn, is learn to be patient. But Zach says he's also learned that there are ways to stay busy, have fun, and maybe do a little business in real estate after the sun sets in Fort Lauderdale.
You got to think out of the box, especially in a market like this, where the same thing that we've been doing obviously isn't working. So instead of having the typical brokers open on a Tuesday or Wednesday afternoon, you know, you have a nice little catered lunch and you parade all the realtors in town through it and hope that one of them has a buyer for your place.
Right.
Most of these agents are either agents that are coming for a free lunch, and let's face it, you know, we're all a little hungry right now. So what we've been doing is we've been having different types of events, you know, cocktail hours, art shows, you know, really had to go a little bit over and beyond to get people to show up and to get people, you know, interested and excited about real estate again.
Okay, details, over and beyond. What are we talking about?
There's a couple listings that we have in the downtown area. We've had a couple cocktail parties where we're actually hired strippers to bartend, one guy and one girl. That way we can appeal to all crowds.
Were they stripping while they were bartending?
No, they were actually clothed, but moderately clothed.
Relatively attractive bodies at the same time, right?
Very attractive bodies and, you know, a little bit of a black fabric on each one of them. They were making drinks. We had sushi, and it was fun.
Did you sell the place?
Yes, I did. through that party, we kind of got a name going, not only with the local brokers and the local agents, but also with that neighborhood. And it was good. It's a very hip crowd. It's, you know, it's these urban style lofts right downtown. You know, a lot of young professionals.
What else had you done to draw people into that particular party?
We do the typical email blast, send out, you know, invitations. We always, you know, over-deliver for having a party, and we're saying that there's going to be food and drinks. You know, we make sure that we have a premium liquor bar and good food. If we say it's going to be professionally catered, you know, we make sure that we go over and beyond. I recently sold a house on the Isles, really nice waterfront home, and it had kind of an island feel to it. So I had the Mai Kai, which is this Polynesian restaurant in town, come and deck the place out, and we had tiki torches and a tiki bar set up on the dock, serving drinks out of coconuts and hula dancers. It was a lot of fun.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Zach Finn's trying to make a living as a real estate agent in Fort Lauderdale. Tough work these days. But he would tell you that he is not a hopeless optimist, but rather a hopeful optimist. And he has a message that's become something of a mantra for folks in the real estate business.
I think it's a great time to buy. I would be out there, you know, doing what the lucky few, I guess we can call them, that are out there in a position to buy seem to be doing.
And you're not just going pitching around me because you're a real estate agent, eh?
No, this isn't a pitch. Are you a Canadian?
Did the A give me away?
Yeah. It did. I won't hold that against you, by the way.
I'm sure you won't.
Yeah, we like the Canadians a lot right now, and we also like the Europeans.
Are the Europeans coming in to buy?
Oh, big time.
Now, what's the attraction? I'm not 100% clear. Where are they coming from?
We have a couple buyers that we're working with right now from London.
All right.
And with the pound being so strong, the dollar being so weak, a lot of these very high-end, sophisticated people feel that that they should be converting some of their money into U.S. dollars, knowing that historically, with the change of our president, our dollar is going to strengthen.
Right.
They feel that the pound is overinflated and can't remain this strong for this long. So they're hoping to get some, you know, some pounds turned into U.S. dollars. And what better way to do it than to take advantage of a depreciated real estate market and buy real estate for 40, 50, 60 cents on the dollar.
What about the places that were or have been foreclosed on? Are they a good buy right now? Are you looking at these places?
Of course. And I'm actually setting up part of my company right now to get into the REO business. It stands for real estate owned. Once a bank takes back a property and then puts it back out there to the market, it's really the best time to buy most of the time.
I've heard some of these places are in pretty rough shape, though.
Yeah, and that's why I say most of the time. I actually helped somebody buy probably the worst condition property I've ever seen in my life. You walked up to this little duplex. You know, it had that blue plastic over the roof, which was covering up part of the holes through the roof. You walked inside and part of the blue tarp was torn and waving around inside the unit. Kitchens were obviously ripped out. The doors were ripped out. The walls were half broken down and the rest were just, you know, completely moldy.
The place sounds like a complete teardown, Zach.
Yeah, it pretty much was a teardown. And this girl actually bought it for less than the land value. And if she was to tear it down, she could build something nice there and end up with a nice rental property out of it.
You just opened up a brand new office, right?
That's correct.
There must be people looking at you, Zach, going, spending all this money to show off a house? You're opening a brand new office? These are desperate times. What are you doing?
I'm doing just that. I'm going over and beyond and doing whatever we can to get the place sold.
And you think you'll make it through?
Oh, yeah. I know I'll make it through. People have a pretty negative opinion about real estate agents in general and how, you know, they think that we just come in, we collect this big commission, you know, we say thank you and give them a bottle of wine and move on. When the reality is that the reason the compensation is what it is because there's a lot of effort that has to go in, a lot of money that needs to be spent to market and to sell property. And a thriving real estate market like it was 3 years ago when people were just running up to you saying, I want to buy this, here's how much, here's a check, to now, people seem to forget how much money needs to be invested in selling a property and that it's not an easy thing to do.
So what's your estimate of turnaround time? What are you thinking?
I don't know. I'd say somewhere between the next 2 months and the next 2 years.
How good are you actually, at holding your breath?
Yeah, I would guarantee it's going to happen between tomorrow and 10 years from now.
Zach Finn is located in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. You can read more about Zach and his tiki torches on our website at thestory.org. Coming up next, a trip to Brazil that turned into a night-long nightmare for a couple from Vermont, and what it is they learned about themselves. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. And one of the kinds of stories that I collect here are those about the pivotal, memorable moments in your life. Roger and Alan Questel from Arlington, Vermont, wrote in about one such dramatic time they shared. It began when they adopted a little girl, Aline, from Brazil. See, the couple later discovered that their new daughter had two sisters still in Brazil, so Roger and Ellen decided to try and adopt them as well. They went back to Brazil, and on their way to meet those girls, decided to spend the evening with a friend there. That's where things started to go wrong.
It was kind of like a dream in many ways because where Bob lived was a retired coffee plantation, and there were maybe six dogs, three little beige poodles and some big mutts and all kinds of dogs running around. There were three children, 2 6-year-olds, which he adopted at the same time, and a 12-year-old. And there was a crusty parrot that sat on the porch, and the parrot would bite, so you couldn't go near him. But he was so used to everyone screaming to the dogs, get out, that the parrot would scream, get out, every time you walk by him. So it was quite comical, but it was tropical and beautiful, and it was on a river. And they set out a beautiful, typical Brazilian dinner. And so it was plates of cheese and plates of meat and bread. And we were there having this lovely dinner at a very large dining room with a very large table, the three children, Bob, his mother, and Ellen and I, when this scene all began.
It was almost comical at first, these two characters came in the window.
The window was open? Or?
Well, the windows were wide open, and the windows were only 3 feet off the ground.
Yeah, it's tropical country, and the windows were open and no screens. And this character came in. He had this hideous Halloween mask on, but truly a hideously frightening one. And I, for a moment, thought that it was Victor, the 12-year-old boy, trying to tease his younger brother and sister. And so I said to Victor, that's not funny. Stop it. Even though my mind wasn't putting it together because Victor was right there at the table.
And what was your first reaction, Roger?
Your mind didn't go to we're being robbed. You thought it was kids because they're wearing Halloween masks and carrying very old guns. Looked like old rifles and old revolvers like the New York City policemen used to use when I was a kid, They kind of had the quality of six shooters. One of them had his shirt pulled over his head and his big belly hanging out. Another one's fly was open with his shirt coming through his fly. Very unkempt.
What are they saying? What are they doing?
They were screaming at the top of their lungs, where are your guns? Where are your cell phones?
Your Portuguese is good enough that you could understand this early part.
Ellen spoke very good Portuguese.
Yeah, I got that they were screaming, where are your guns? I caught that.
And they pointed the guns right at our heads and grabbed Bob, who was at the head of the table and clearly was able to communicate with them.
It became apparent almost immediately that this was very serious. Victor, the 12-year-old, started to shake, and Bob got very, very serious. It only took, I don't know how many seconds, but a brief period of time to realize that this was the real thing.
Ellen and Roger Questel found themselves in the middle of an armed house invasion, facing 5 or 6 gunmen. Now, they were far from anywhere in rural Brazil. And things were just going from bad to worse.
They put a gun right to Victor's head, the 12-year-old, and that was pretty horrifying. And Roger, I think at that point, was sitting very close to Victor.
I had my arms around him, yeah.
And so at that point, I said in English something to the effect of, don't point that gun at that child.
She screamed it.
And I don't know whether it was because I had some maternal authority or maybe he just thought this woman's going to get hysterical, but he did put the gun down. He pointed it down away from Victor's head. And at that point, they asked Bob, who are these people that speak English? Who are they? Because we were a total surprise to them. And Bob said, thinking he would mollify them, saying, oh, well, they're Americans and they're here to do a good deed. They've come to adopt two Brazilian girls. And the response was, oh, yeah, to take them back to America and use them for their livers and their lungs. So it was like, oh, dear, that didn't go well.
Maybe we need to change your story.
All this was happening at the top of their lungs. They were screaming to try to scare everybody. So it did have the feeling that violence could break out at any second, and that's why we were trying to keep from moving too quickly.
We were all seated around the dining table, and they would take us each out individually. They took Bob's mother out individually. They took Bob out. They took each person out, and then the rest of us were left at the table with the children and some other guns pointed at us. And we learned later from Bob that they had taken him to the family safe, and he had to open it. And in it was a gun that had been his grandfather's that he had forgotten was there. And they were furious. One of them put a gun to his head and said, well, now we're going to play Russian roulette. We don't want to kill you outright because you're a brave man or something. But he remained really remarkably calm. And when we were around the dining table, at one point, the dogs were barking so loud that they stood up and said they were going to shoot the dogs. And I remember feeling incredibly frightened that everything would fall apart if they started to shoot the animals. And Bob was very calm. He got up and he just said no, and he called the big dogs and he locked them up in an adjoining room. That worked. They were no longer, you know, threatening about the animals, and that was a huge relief.
At one point, they grabbed Ellen and I and they grabbed me by the T-shirt and stuck a gun in my back and forced us down the hall into the bedroom where our things were. Luckily, Bob came along because we didn't speak enough Portuguese.
Yeah.
And we were staying in Bob's bedroom. He was generous enough to give us the master bedroom that night. And they stole everything, all our clothes, even Bob's underwear. You know, we had about $4,000 in cash because you can't get cash in Brazil the way you can here. You can get like $25 from a cash machine. We gave them everything. We even had money in different places, and we brought it all out.
You didn't pause. You didn't think, oh, I don't have to show them what's in the back of the suitcase. They'll probably never find that.
Well,
I didn't.
Roger didn't.
Take the money.
I had a travel kind of bag that had a million zippers, and they had it in their hands, and they were ransacking it. And I didn't have the money all in one compartment. It was in different compartments, so I didn't say anything. And, you know, just they had the purse. And when they discovered there was more money and that I hadn't pointed out where it was, at that point they got really furious at Bob and threatened to kill him for lying. And he said, but you've had the bag the whole time in your hands, so that was okay. That was a mistake I made. I should have just pointed out the money to begin with.
You're listening to The Story and to Roger and Ellen Questel's memories of being caught up in an armed house invasion in a rural part of Brazil. After some time, the thieves settled in with whiskey and beer and started calling friends on their newly stolen cell phones. After about 4 hours of this, the man who owned the house, a man called Bob, spoke up.
Bob said, you've got everything we have now. Why don't you leave? And they said, there's no hurry.
What's the hurry?
The hurry? So we really didn't know what was going to happen.
And it was extremely tense.
So what did happen?
They got bored. And around midnight, they asked Bob, do you have a place we can lock you up? And luckily, there was a basement that had a key on the outside. And so they marched us all out of the living room outside to this side door of the basement. And I was desperately afraid that they were going to bring us to this room and shoot us because it had a kind of a bad feeling going into a basement at that moment. When we got to the basement, it was not a bad room. It actually had lights, and it was filled with old beds. And they brought us in there and then said to us, if you try anything for 1 hour, we'll kill you. And then they locked the door from the outside, and we were all left alone in there. After about 15 minutes, they took all the cars, so there was two or three cars, and we heard them all drive away. And that's the point where I was truly euphoric.
Was that really the first time that you thought, okay, this will have a happy ending, at least as far as our own personal safety is concerned?
I felt it was over. I was ecstatic. And I immediately wanted to take the hinges off the door and get out of that basement.
But actually, Victor and I were the restraining forces.
Victor was the 12-year-old, right?
The 12-year-old. And Victor and I kept saying, wait a minute, we lived. What does it matter if we wait another 45 minutes?
And they had asked you to wait an hour, right? So you were thinking, yes. What if they'd left a guard outside or something
yes.
like that?
Exactly. And I'm thinking, you know, we're alive. I don't mind waiting in this basement another 45 minutes. And Victor and I were just beseeching Roger not to try to get out and not to do anything.
But yeah, the door was locked. What were you going to do anyway?
I was going to, you know, turn into MacGyver and unscrew the hinges from the door. I was going to figure it out. I was going to take apart the bed and make a crowbar. I don't know. But I was very elated is the word. I mean, I really felt light as a feather because I had heard those trucks drive away, those cars drive away. And so in my heart, in my mind, this was over. And we had lived. Everyone was safe. There was a very small window that only Victor could fit through, and it had two steel bars across it that were embedded in the stone on either side. And to this day, I wonder if I had one of those experiences you read about where the mother picks the truck up off her child, because I climbed up on the bed, and I said, oh, we can get out this way, and I grabbed the bar, and to me, the bar felt soft. I took it, and I bent it, and pulled it out, and then I took the other one, and I bent it, and I pulled it out, and they felt almost rubbery to me. You know, I don't remember straining or grunting or anything. I said, oh, we can get out this way. And we slipped Victor, the 12-year-old, out the window, and he came running back with a key. And that was probably 1 o'clock in the morning. And we all went back inside the house. We were all very shaken. And the house was a wreck. Literally everything was thrown everywhere. And so we started picking up clothes and standing up the furniture again and collecting all the documents that were strewn all over the floor and finding our driver's licenses and our passports. And,
did Bob call the police, or was there even any point in doing that?
We had no phones.
There were no phones and right. No transportation. We were stuck there.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Remember now, Roger and Ellen Questel were in Brazil on their way to adopt two girls. They eventually found their way to the police the next day.
And they said, we have, you know, hundreds of these every week, and we have 9 police officers. They said something like, we even know who did it, but we don't know how to find them. Because São Paulo and Brazil suffers from the kind of poverty where there are favelas, where there are huge shanty towns all over filled with street kids.
Yeah.
And the police can hardly go in there even, because they have their own society, essentially.
What did you guys do to sort of get back on track? You'd lost all your money. You'd probably had clothes and other things taken. Did you continue on with the trip to adopt the girls?
We had to postpone our meeting with the judge for one day because Roger had no clothes.
I mean, I had the clothes I was wearing, yeah, you know.
And they'd stolen all the others.
They'd taken our suitcases.
And we had no money. We still had our plane tickets, I think. But we found an American Express office, and I think we got $1,000.
No, it was $2,500.
Oh, $2,500.
We figured we needed $4,000. It takes about 2 months to adopt a child in Brazil. You have to stay for a month and meet with social workers, and then it takes about a month to do all the paperwork to leave the country. So we flew on to Florianopolis, where we had other friends, and we drove 4 hours to Criciúma, the town where the girls were, and went on with it.
I'm also interested in knowing what you guys think. Looking back on that moment, you learned about yourselves because you're in a foreign country. You're being held at gunpoint by some very rough young thieves who are, you know, speaking a language that's hard for you guys to follow. You've lost everything, and you made it through. What did you guys learn about yourselves?
I learned that I behaved better than I thought I would have, that I didn't go to pieces. And even afterwards, there wasn't a lot of post-traumatic kind of stress afterwards. I guess we were so busy and we had so much to do. I guess in terms of long-term changes, that I am more cautious now maybe about traveling to some places that I didn't have caution before, that I know these things can happen. But the oddest immediate effect it had on me was when we were staying in this little hotel afterwards and we had the girls, we had a TV set in the room and it had one English, you know, channel with American films, and Roger would kind of flip through the stations and always end up on these old films. And I remember walking in the room once and seeing like an old gangster movie, you know, with some guy pulling a gun, and just thinking, I can't even watch this. You know, this isn't...
It's not a movie anymore.
It's not a movie anymore.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Roger Questel is the one who pulled those steel bars out as part of their escape. But beyond that, what about the effect on him of surviving that ordeal?
I can't describe the kind of euphoria that I went through for 2 full weeks. I mean, I was ecstatic because I'd never been under that much pressure and that much pressure relieved before. But I grew up in New York City as a kid. And when you grow up as a kid on Second Avenue in New York, you kind of think, I know how to handle myself. I've been around the world. I can see the bad guys coming. You lose that. And then as you think of places to go and things you're going to do, when you see people with guard dogs and guns in front of an apartment building, you know, like in a place like Ecuador or something, you no longer feel like, I think I'll go for a walk anyway. You've lost that immunity.
That, is that a good thing?
Well, I guess it's part of growing up, huh? You know, when you can carry that feeling of it'll never happen to me.
Yeah.
And I guess all kids do until they have their first, you know, scrape in a car or something. Then they start to slow down. But I don't know if it's a good thing. No, I think it was much more fun to have the feeling of I can go anywhere and do anything and to not be afraid to be, you know, walking down the streets of some city at 2 in the morning.
I was going to say, you two have 2 children from Brazil, sisters. I'm wondering, have you told them this story or were you careful? How did you manage that?
Well, we told our older girl because we had to. We arrived a day late and it was too big an event not to have told her, and she was already 17. We didn't tell Eleni, who was only 11 at the time. We didn't tell her because that would have been too frightening for her. But we did tell her a couple of years ago, so she knows the story now. And I have a grown son, and we told him, and I think it was kind of interesting. We were so euphoric at having survived that we kind of told the story in a cavalier way to our friends when we first were staying at this hotel. You know, we made a few long-distance calls and told them about what happened. And they were all incredibly distressed and upset, and some of them were in tears. And it was almost like Roger and I hadn't fully owned what had happened to us yet.
Hadn't really sunk in what danger you were in, maybe.
Right.
Roger and Ellen Questel joined me from a studio in Manchester, Vermont, and we have some pictures of the Questel family on our website at thestory.org. Roger and Ellen wrote in with their story. They knew they had one worth telling. You can do the same thing. Let me give you a couple of hints of stories that we're particularly looking for these days in light of what we're hearing from both China and Burma. We're looking for stories of people who are doing the kind of rescue work in difficult places like China, not the kind of story that says, oh, well, I'm tough and I saved lives, I did it and I'll do it again, but more about what the stress is on you if you're in a situation like that, how difficult it is to deliver that kind of assistance under circumstances that are so difficult. And we're always looking for those political moments in your life, the ones that really mattered, perhaps the first time you voted, perhaps something else I haven't thought of. Go to our website at thestory.org or leave me a message on our telephone at 1-888-966-9862. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.